This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, hosting comparative coffee and tea tastings all month at Pete's 7 Portland locations, including new locations on Hawthorne and in Vancouver. Details at PEETS.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Bill Sizemore wins his appeal against a major decision that destroyed his political group, Taxpayers United. The FBI is investigating leaks to the media about its own corruption. Plus, the Iraq Study Group's hidden agenda extends the economic invasion of Iraq.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,520 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 52,889 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count at more than 650,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, December 7th, 2006. I'm Sun Lee.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. Anti-tax activist Bill Sizemore won a major legal victory yesterday. A state appeals court said he is not responsibly personally liable for a $2.5 million racketeering judgment that teachers' unions won against his groups in 2002. In October, the Oregon Court of Appeals said Sizemore and his groups engaged in fraud and racketeering against the unions. The court said Sizemore deliberately strained the unions financially by getting them to spend millions of dollars to fight a pair of anti-union ballot measures in November of 2000. At the time, the state's lawyer said it appeared Sizemore was personally liable for most of the financial penalty the unions won against him and his now-defunct group, Oregon Taxpayers United. But ruling in a related case yesterday, the Court of Appeals took the opportunity to clarify the October decision by saying Sizemore is not personally liable for the money. Greg Hartman, a lawyer who represents the union, said Sizemore engaged in significant misconduct in the initiative campaigns and that the unions will keep pressing their legal case. Son?
Now an update on Walmart and its Gresham site fight. Walmart and its opponents have asked the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals to review a Gresham Land Use Board decision blocking a supercenter on Southeast 182nd Avenue and Powell. Gresham has twice rejected Walmart's attempts to build on the spot, citing traffic problems. In November, a Gresham hearings officer ruled that traffic from the proposed store might jam nearby intersections, but Walmart says their studies prove the intersections would still meet city standards. The Gresham hearings officer ruled in favor of Walmart on several other issues, ranging from pedestrian requirements to zoning. Store opponents have filed a notice that they will appeal on those issues. A Land Use Board of Appeals decision is expected in the spring of 2007.
Senate President Peter Courtney says he senses growing support among lawmakers for giving annual legislative sessions a test drive beginning in January. It's an idea he believes would help bring the legislature into the 21st century. The Salem Democrat says he's been meeting with House and Senate members of both parties and thinks they are open to having a session limited to 120 days in 2007, followed by a 60-day session in 2008. In a tradition that dates to Oregon's statehood, the legislature has met every other year instead of annually, as in most states. Courtney and others say that having annual sessions with limits on how long they could last would prevent runaway sessions that drag well into the summer months.
Across the state of Oregon, communities are holding benefits and events in honor of Army soldier Suzanne Swift, who faces court-martial next week. Swift went AWOL after being sexually coerced by her commanding officers in Iraq. In Eugene last night, a number of peace groups held a showing of the documentary film about Iraq to raise money for Swift's legal defense. The film is called The Ground Truth, The Human Cost of War. Amy Merwin has more on the Eugene Report.
Here to tell us about this is one of the organizers for the Justice Not War Coalition, Rich Klopper. So can you please tell us about this film, The Ground Truth?
Well, the film focuses on the stories of soldiers that returned to the United States from Iraq. It's their personal stories of the struggles they had in reintegrating back into civilian life after seeing some horrific things in Iraq.
Does it also tell their stories of their experiences in Iraq?
Oh, yeah. They go into great detail, and there's footage of the war in Iraq. This might be a good time to warn people that there's some pretty graphic and disturbing scenes in the film.
So in other words, this is not the type of thing that you'd see on CNN, because they censor all that really ugly stuff so that we don't develop even more outrage at our occupation and invasion of Iraq that has now turned into a civil war.
Exactly. And there's no footage that is included just to horrify. It's all used to tell the story of what these veterans are experiencing and why they find it so difficult to be back with their families and back in civilian life after being in such a horrific place.
Is it pretty much a common denominator that each of these vets have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD?
That is the thread that runs through the entire film. I'm certainly no expert on PTSD, but what I would consider some of the classic symptoms are sleep trouble, domestic violence, trouble getting and holding down a job, depression, anger. Each one has their own story. They're very powerful, very clear, lucid accounts of serving and feeling like they did their job in their service to their country. Many of them had doubts while they were there, but the film goes into a lot of detail about how human beings are trained to kill other human beings and how that is not a natural concept for humans. And these veterans that are interviewed in the film are keenly aware that that's where their problems began, in that dehumanizing training that the military gives them.
Why is it important for people to go and see this film without just upsetting themselves even more?
Well, I hope this film reaches beyond the usual people that might go to these, but I don't want people to just be angry and hopeless. There'll be resources there. There'll be tabling from the Committee for Counter-Military Recruitment and some local resources for folks to get involved. And I want people to be aware that when these troops come home, we're going to have a huge societal-wide problem, and we ought to be thinking about it right now. And I'm hoping this film's objective is to open people's eyes and to be supportive of those soldiers when they do come home and reintegrate.
So will there also be discussion after the film?
There will be a time where we can decompress from having watched this fairly intense film and have a discussion around where we can go from here.
And now that we're in a lame duck session of Congress and we're in a situation in which the Democrats will control the House and the Senate come January, will there be organizing happening to start demanding that there be support for these veterans as well as a way to bring these people and National Guard home so that they can start getting back to some normalcy in their life and seek out the emotional support and mental health services that they might need?
And not in a partisan way, but the Democratic Party has always been more supportive of veteran services. So I'm hoping that veteran services that have been cut over the last number of years, Republican-controlled Congress, will be reinstated and they'll realize the gravity of the problem and fully fund the enormity of this society-wide problem. And the other part of that is that the work just doesn't stop. We will have to be very vigilant in lobbying our congressional members to bring the troops home immediately.
If people want to learn more about this event or about Justice Not War, how would they do so?
The phone number at Justice Not War Coalition is 606-2877, and the calc is 485-1755.
This is Amy Merwin.
Narcotics officers arrested two Myrtle Creek residents this week after allegedly finding them with more than 90 pounds of marijuana. Narcotics team officers arranged through an informant to buy a large quantity of marijuana from 50-year-old John Lee Nelson and 52-year-old Dolores Nelson. The deal called for the purchase of 50 pounds of marijuana for $125,000. Officers at the residence found plants stored in 5-gallon buckets. A second site in Myrtle Creek was also searched. Officers reported finding another 17 pounds of marijuana. The Nelsons are charged with the unlawful possession, manufacturing, and delivery of marijuana.
Lane County Sheriff's Office volunteers rescued a New Jersey man early yesterday who's ridden a sport utility vehicle got stuck in snow on a remote forest service road near here. Joseph Anstad of Pennington, New Jersey, was headed from Eugene to Crater Lake on regular highways Tuesday night, but decided on a shortcut after looking at a map, authorities said. Volunteers found Anstad at 2 a.m. Wednesday and helped free his rig. They led him to the road and sent him on his way. He was found in the foothills of the Cascade Mountain hours before the body of James Kim of San Francisco was found in the southern Oregon Coast Range 4 days after he left his stranded family to seek help. The Kims, too, had taken a shortcut through snowy mountains. Anstad followed the tracks of a truck, Miller said, as he neared the Douglas County line. He got stuck in the snow. He had no chains. The snow got deeper and crustier until he got stuck and couldn't move backward or forward, Miller said. Anstad walked about 6 miles to find a cell phone signal. He called 911, then returned to the truck. That was a smart move, Miller said. At the truck, Anstad has shelter and some provisions. That's your survival, so stay put, Miller says. They found Anstad at 2 a.m. and had freed him uninjured by 4 a.m.
Oregonians are being urged to find alternatives to fireplaces and wood stoves that contribute to the pollution trapped by stagnant air covering much of the state. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality issued an air quality advisory for southern and eastern Oregon recommending against open burning. The DEQ also requested limited use of uncertified wood stoves where stagnant air conditions exist. Stagnant air traps fine particles of smoke at ground level where they can enter the lungs and cause damage. Affected cities include Roseburg, Grants Pass, Medford, Klamath Falls, Lakeview, Burns, Hines, Ontario, Baker City, John Day, and LeGrand.
The designer of Clark College's new Eastside campus in Vancouver says the new facility will not only be green, but uniquely smart. Timothy Buckley, an associate and project architect for Vancouver-based LSW Architects, called it brain-based design. He says studies show that increased natural lighting, large projection screen displays, acoustics, ergonomic furnishings, even the right color palette can boost learning. If funded, the project could break ground by July near Mill Plain Boulevard at Columbia Tech Center. Buckley's design also surpassed the state-mandated certification from the U.S. Green Building Council's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Program. The environmental elements include orienting the building to maximize natural daylight and conserve energy sources, incorporating solar panels and micro wind turbines, and collecting and treating rainwater.
Congressional negotiators have reached agreement on a massive tax and trade package, which would extend tax breaks, normalize trade with Vietnam, and save doctors from an impending cut in Medicare payments. The bill also encompasses a stall plan to open more than 8 million acres along the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas drilling and expand an abandoned coal mine reclamation program. The Vietnam bill would end the Cold War requirement that trade with the communist state be reviewed every year. The trade package would also extend or expand trade breaks for Haiti, sub-Saharan Africa, and Andean nations. Also still on the agenda was congressional approval of an agreement with India that would allow the United States to ship civilian nuclear fuel and technology to that country.
20 years ago, Larry and Donna Charpide filed the first lawsuit to stop Los Angeles County from putting one of the nation's biggest dumps on the edge of Joshua Tree National Park, N1. Now the two jojoba farmers are still railing against the landfill proposed for the site of an abandoned mine 2 miles from the state's most famous natural treasure. They've been joined by national environmental groups as the case heads for the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco. Ontario-based Kaiser Ventures has been trying to turn its former Eagle Mountain iron ore pits into a garbage dump since 1987. The county, which could run out of landfill space by 2013, agreed to buy the Joshua Tree property once the lawsuits were resolved. It would send about 20,000 tons of garbage there each day for 100 years.
Fruit growers are being urged to look for alternative pest controls as government regulators look to quash the use of insecticides deemed unsafe by farm worker advocacy groups. In 1999, Washington apple growers used 8 so-called organophosphate insecticides in their orchards to battle pests. By 2004, the number had fallen to just 4. One insecticide under fire is AZM, long employed in apple orchards to eradicate calding moths. The EPA announced last month it would phase out the use of AZM by 2012. Organophosphates are among the most commonly used pesticides worldwide, both for agriculture and domestic use. For humans, overexposure can cause acute toxic effects such as wheezing, nausea, headaches, seizures, and in extreme cases, death.
8 Los Angeles hotel workers have begun a 7-day water-only fast as part of their push for a living wage. Tandi Chimurjinda reports from Los Angeles.
As part of their efforts to secure a living wage, 18 workers from various LAX hotels began a 7-day water-only fast last evening with a candlelight procession. The LA City Council passed a living wage ordinance for 3500 Century Boulevard hotel workers on November 22nd, and the legislation was signed into law by Mayor Villaraigosa 5 days later, raising their wages to $10.60 an hour, or $9.40 an hour for those with health benefits. But the hotels and other business groups along Century Boulevard are now seeking to repeal the law through a ballot referendum. The workers will fast and set up shop outside of the hotels until December 12th. Jasmine Ortiz is a parking cashier at the LAX Hilton.
I'm proud to be part of this fasting because it's a way for our kids to have a future. Because if we don't have a present right now, our kids, they're not going to have a future. They cannot be sent to college. They cannot have a better life in the future. I'm a mom. I'm a head of the family, and it's hard.
For FSRN, this is Tandisizwe Shimaringa in Los Angeles.
The National League of Cities is releasing a new study in Reno today that underscores the plight of cities as they try to address a lack of affordable housing. The study says the availability of such housing has worsened in fully one-third of the nation's cities in the past year. It also says 4 out of 5 of the local housing directors surveyed reported the value of homes and rental costs have increased significantly. The result is severe financial strain on more and more families. In addition, one-third reported predatory lending on the increase, and more than half indicated it is a problem in their city.
The number of newly laid off workers filing claims for unemployment benefits dropped last week by the largest amount in 6 months. The decrease was in line with expectations of economists, who believe that an unexpectedly large jump of claims the previous week was an aberration. The 4-week moving average for jobless claims edged up slightly to the highest level since May, while the number of Americans receiving claims rose to the highest level since January. Even with those increases, analysts said the labor market appears to be withstanding this year's economic slowdown. This was brought on by a big drop in the once booming housing market and weaknesses in other areas such as auto sales.
Thank you, son. More American homes are getting discounted oil from Venezuela's state-owned oil company. The company's U.S. subsidiary, Citgo, is expanding a program that's part of a promise by Venezuela's socialist leader to aid America's poor. Citgo made its first delivery of discounted heating oil yesterday to a woman in Baltimore. It is the first of 15,000 needy households in Maryland that are slated to get the discounted fuel. Citgo says it's expanding the program beyond the Northeast to provide oil at the discounted rate to 16 states. Last year, the program provided nearly 40 million gallons. This year, that number is expected to reach more than 100 million gallons. The U.S. is still the top buyer of Venezuelan oil, but relations between the two countries have been tense since Hugo Chavez took office.
After the first of the year, the Environmental Protection Agency's final Ground Zero contamination cleanup will get underway. $7 million will be spent on testing the air and dust in nearby buildings for contaminants like asbestos and lead. But one EPA official says most buildings have been cleaned repeatedly, and he sees little likelihood of risk from the dust that's still there. Yet the whole plan is not sitting well with New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who calls it totally inadequate. She wants to expand the testing area. Clinton is a frequent EPA critic who accuses the agency of not protecting the public health after the World Trade Center collapsed.
The FBI has begun several internal investigations over leaks to the media about public corruption probes shortly before last month's elections. At least one of the alleged leaks involves the federal inquiry of Representative Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania. He lost his House seat weeks after the FBI raided the homes and offices of his daughter and her business partner. Leak investigations at the FBI are rare, former agents and experts said. They are hard to prove, particularly if some of the information has already been reported in the media or revealed in court documents. Disclosing information a grand jury is considering is a serious crime, and such leaks often aim to sway public opinion.
After a district judge ordered FEMA to restore housing payments to Katrina survivors, the agency appealed its case. FEMA's critics say the agency is wasting tax dollars and prolonging storm victims' suffering. Yan Meixie reports in Washington, D.C.
A week after Hurricane Katrina made landfall, New Orleanian Robert Coakley landed in a Washington, D.C. apartment, paid for by FEMA.
Things were going very good. We were transitioning very well. And guess what? All of a sudden, my housing was totally taken away from me.
The shocking news came in February, 5 months after Katrina, when FEMA started to close out one of its housing programs, which covered Coakley. He felt he was hit by another storm.
Rent's four times what I was used to. Here, a $10 bag of groceries cost $19. This is what I was facing, no contacts in the city, and I thought I was going to be out on the street, and I did not know why.
In order to reapply for housing assistance, evacuees have to provide FEMA a series of documents, a process Coakley calls an absolute joke.
The appeal process was like trying to pin the tail on a donkey or trying to break the piñata. You don't know where it is, you don't know what you're fighting, it was like shadow boxing.
After dancing in the dark for days, Coakley finally hit the piñata. FEMA restored his rental benefits. However, not everyone was so lucky. FEMA denied thousands of Katrina bird families their housing assistance, and in the computer-generated denial letters, FEMA used phrases such as ineligible-other to explain why benefits were denied. In August, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, or ACORN, filed a lawsuit against FEMA. Last week, U.S. District Judge Richard Leon ruled in favor of ACORN and ordered FEMA to restart the housing program immediately. FEMA appealed on Tuesday. In a written statement, the agency says it has provided enough time and sufficient guidance for evacuees to reapply for help. Today, ACORN took the case to Capitol Hill, asking Congress members to pressure FEMA to withdraw. ACORN spokesperson Mary Spencer.
The lives of innocent American citizens have been jeopardized due to the negligent actions of our federal agency, FEMA. The people who endured devastation in one part of their lives should be treated as people living in America and not yesterday's trash.
A dozen Democratic Congress members signed a letter urging FEMA to drop the appeal. Congressman Al Green, a Democrat from Texas, says a rebuke to FEMA should come from the very top.
It's time for the president to say to FEMA, FEMA, withdraw. Withdraw this notice of appeal. FEMA works for the president. And I think it's time for the boss to come forward and say, enough is enough.
Democratic Representative Maxine Waters of California is slated to chair a House panel on housing when Democrats take over Congress next year.
I intend to make my first order of business a hearing down in New Orleans to deal with the mess that has been created, the lack of housing, the inability for residents to return, and the ineptitude and mismanagement of FEMA.
Robert Coakley says he just doesn't understand why FEMA prefers spending money in dragging out the lawsuit rather than helping storm victims.
It's silly. It's stupid.
For Free Speech Radio News, Yan Meixie in Washington, D.C.
plan to build a mosque in the Houston suburb Katy has blown up into a neighborhood dispute. Many neighborhood residents claim they have nothing against Muslims and are more concerned about property values, drainage, and traffic. But one resident has set up an anti-Islamic website with an odometer-like counter that keeps track of terrorist attacks since September 11. And next-door neighbor Craig Baker has threatened to raise pigs on the edge of the property of the Muslim Holy Day. Muslims consider pigs unclean and do not eat pork. For the 11 lands, an acre site include a mosque, a community center that would offer after-school activities, housing for senior citizens, a fitness center, and an Islamic school.
A Florida man who had to vote in a Catholic church last month is suing election officials. Jerry Rabinowitz of Delray Beach argues that casting a ballot amid crucifixes and anti-abortion banners violates the separation of church and state. Rabinowitz is a non-observant Jew. He says elections officials refuse to remove or cover religious items at Emmanuel Catholic Church. He says that amounted to government endorsement of religion. Rabinowitz is being represented by a legal center affiliated with the American Humanist Association. Humanists believe in leading ethical lives, but without religious doctrine or the worship of a god.
The current time is 5:26, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If terrorists and drug pushers had lobbyists and made campaign contributions, Washington would probably coddle them. For an example of Washington coddling an axis of evil, look no further than our generals, Philip Morris, and the other corporate members of the global tobacco cartel. For decades, these greed heads have intentionally addicted millions of people for profit, targeting our kids with their murderous products and killing some 438,000 Americans every single year. Yet they're allowed to keep hooking kids and keep killing. The tobacco giants are beyond redemption. Even after being publicly exposed and fined billions of dollars, they persist in attacking us. A new study finds that these profiteers have secretly been escalating the addictive firepower of their little weapons of mass destruction. Since 1998, they've increased the amount of nicotine delivered through their cigarettes by an average of 10%. Of 116 brands tested, 92 had jacked up levels of nicotine. Most damning, some of the biggest increases came in brands that are pitched to young people. Marlboro, for example, the choice of two-thirds of high school smokers, had a 12% jump in nicotine. Also, in a deceptive twist, 73 brands labeled light or ultra-light ranked among the highest in nicotine content. This is not coincidence. It's a conscious corporate choice. As a federal judge found in a recent landmark case, tobacco companies do extensive research on how to hook people, and they have, quote, designed their cigarettes to precisely control nicotine delivery levels and provide doses of nicotine sufficient to create and sustain addiction. This is Jim Hightower saying, if they were drug kingpins or terrorists, tobacco executives would be in deep, dark jail cells. But thanks to their lobbyists and political money, these killer corporations get away without even having their products regulated.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Stay tuned for Africa on Fire at 6 p.m. following this newscast. The guest is Baba Wage Jakite. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. And tonight's weather, the skies are filled with beautiful cloud patterns today and tomorrow. Make it a point to go out and watch the sunrise or sunset. Highs in the Willamette Valley around 45 degrees. Much colder in the gorge with highs there around 35 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Though some news reports say the Mexican state of Oaxaca has returned to relative calm, Eyewitnesses say many continue to live in a state of fear, especially after numerous interrogations and arrests this week. Free Speech Radio News reporter Catherine Kopp spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center, who recently returned to Mexico City from Oaxaca.
Could you describe the latest developments in the government-led crackdown on protesters in Oaxaca?
Several days ago, a group of leaders of the Oaxacan movement came to Mexico City to begin once again a process of negotiation with the federal government. One of the major demands was the liberation of almost 140 political prisoners that were taken out of state and put in prison in the state of Nayarit. Also, of course, the central demand of the movement has been the resignation of the governor, Ulysses Ruiz. When they were here about to go into negotiations, the police came and arrested three of the negotiators and has taken them to prisons in different parts of the country. One of the most visible people is Flavio Sosa, who has been a leader of the movement since it began and is a member of the opposition party, the Party of the Democratic Revolution. So, of course, there was a lot of outrage about this because, on the one hand, you don't arrest negotiators.
Mexican President Calderón just recently took office. What is your assessment of the new president's attitude toward this resistance movement?
As a first message for a president coming into office, to take the path of repressing a broad and democratic and largely peaceful popular movement in the state of Oaxaca by putting its leaders in jail is a very, very bad signal. It's got everybody worried, not only people who are involved in the Oaxacan movement, but everybody who works for change, in social change in Mexico. The attorney general that was appointed by the new president is named Medina Mora, and he is the same person who sent in the federal troops to Oaxaca as the Secretary of Public Security, and he's also the same person who was largely responsible for the federal government participation in the repression that took place in Atenco. And that was a terrible case that still has many, many human rights violations and accusations pending. And the Secretary of the Interior, who's handling these negotiations, also has a past of repressing movements in his home state of Jalisco at an anti-globalization demonstration where there was basically a roundup of demonstrators who were placed in prison, many of whom also suffered, according to accusations, torture at the hands of the state government. So we're seeing a collection of signs that don't look at all good for movements that are peacefully and legally asking for social change, and that could be an indication that we're going to see a right-wing government that's even more repressive than we've seen in the past.
You've called the demonstrations in Oaxaca Mexico's most important social justice rebellion in recent years, but there are reports of many people fleeing the city of Oaxaca. What impact do you think this will have on the campaigns of the People's Assembly of Oaxaca and the education workers who are occupying the state capital?
They've declared that they're going to continue. In fact, there's a major march organized for Sunday in Oaxaca, and also there will be like solidarity marches in other parts of the nation. They've found new allies or made stronger allies. For example, now that Flavio Sosa, who is a member of the PRD, was arrested, the PRD and what they call the Broad Progressive Front, which is a coalition of three political parties that protested the electoral fraud of July 2nd, has become a stronger ally. At the same time, because of the violence, particularly on November 25th, there are people are becoming alienated from the process. There's some question about the continued participation of members of the university union. And people within the city, of course, are also scared. However, we're not really seeing a mass exodus, and the chances are it looks that the movement will be continuing.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the International Relations Center, speaking to FSRN from Mexico City.
That was FSRN's Catherine Kopp.
President Bush, admitting that it's bad in Iraq, acknowledged today that there needs to be a new approach in the unpopular war. Bush said he was disappointed in the progress in Iraq, but continued to oppose direct U.S. talks with Iran or Syria. Bush's speech came a day after the Iraq Study Group issued a stinging report saying the Bush policies in Iraq have failed and a major course correction was needed, including beginning to withdraw combat troops. The study group concluded that a stable democratic Iraq was still possible, but Baker said, quote, "We do not know if it can be turned around." Bush was more upbeat, but gave no hints about whether he was contemplating a major policy shift.
The newly released Iraq Study Group report recommends that the United States engage in direct diplomatic talks with Iran and Syria using incentives and disincentives for the two nations. It also states that the key to success in Iraq is to engage neighboring nations into reconstructing the country. Iranian Affairs correspondent Sideh Jamshidi reports.
A 149-page report of the Iraq Study Group, commonly known as Baker-Hamilton Commission, has 79 recommendations for the White House, but concentrated its effort in three key areas. A change in the primary mission of the U.S. force in Iraq that enables the United States to move out of Iraq responsibly. The Iraqi government's prompt action to achieve reconciliation, and a change to the United States' diplomatic effort in the region to engage neighboring countries, including Iran and Syria, to reinforce stability. This is for the first time that a high-ranking official committee recommended direct diplomacy with Iran since the abrupt diplomatic disconnection between the two countries in 1979 after Iran's revolution. Gary Sieg was the former National Security Council staff under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran.
I would be very surprised if the Bush administration would in fact accept the recommendation to go to direct negotiation.
But Gary Sieg also believes that continuous refusal of direct negotiations would harm their national interests in the region, and eventually the direct diplomatic talk is inevitable for both states.
I think they are very conscious. I think Iran is very conscious of the fact that if the United States leaves suddenly or in a very disorganized way, that Iraq is likely to go into an all-out civil war, which could, in the end, threaten the preeminence of the Shia, which they have just gained at some great difficulty. And I think, to that degree at least, trying to coordinate with the Americans about how this is done could be very important.
Mansour Farhang is the former Iranian ambassador to the United Nations and a professor of international relations in Bennington College in Vermont. He believes Iran is more than ready to talk with the United States.
I'm in the opinion that if Bush administration sent an invitation to Iranian government that they would want to talk to representatives of Iranian government in Geneva on a particular date, Iranians would say yes.
Farhang suggests the United States would move forward in its diplomacy with Iran if
America finds it in its own national interest to engage Iran, as the Baker-Hamilton Commission and many other leading foreign policy experts in this country suggest, then they will pursue their own interests.
According to a recent Reuters poll, Americans favor diplomacy on Iran. At the UN General Assembly last September, President Bush stated America's willingness to give diplomacy more time when dealing with the Iran's nuclear dispute. Professor Sieg believes this will not be an easy task.
It's going to be very hard to find an answer to the problem without some direct contact with Iran, and I think we should be prepared for that.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saeeda Jamshid.
Among its recommendations, the Iraq Study Group advised that Iraq privatize its oil industry and to open it up to international companies. Amy Goodman today interviewed author and activist Antonio Yuhas. She is the author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time.
It's a completely radical proposal made straightforward in the Iraq Study Group report that the Iraqi national oil industry should be reorganized as a commercial enterprise The proposal also says that Iraq's oil should be opened up to private foreign energy and oil companies. Also, another radical proposal that all of Iraq's oil revenues should be centralized in the central government. And the report calls for a U.S. advisor to ensure that a new national oil law is passed in Iraq to make all of this possible, and that the constitution of Iraq is amended to ensure that the central government gains control of Iraq's oil revenues. All told, the report calls for privatization of Iraq's oil, turning it over to private foreign corporate hands, putting all of the oil in the hands of the central government, and essentially, I would argue, extending the war in Iraq to ensure that U.S. oil companies get what the Bush administration went in there for, control and greater access to Iraq's oil. In particular, in this case, both Baker and Eagleburger were key participants throughout the 80s and early 1990s of radically expanding U.S. economic engagement with Saddam Hussein, with the very clear objective of gaining greater access for U.S. corporations, particularly oil corporations, to Iraq's oil. Now, these two members of the Iraq Study Group are joined by two additional members who are representatives of the Heritage Foundation. And the Heritage Foundation is one of the few U.S. organizations that point blank called for full privatization of Iraq's oil sector prior to the invasion of Iraq as a stated goal of the invasion. For the Iraq Study Group, which is supposed to be, you know, the meeting of the pragmatists, the sort of middle ground group that's going to help solve the war in Iraq, to put forward this incredibly radical proposal and to have nobody talk about it, to me is fairly shocking, and makes clear that still the Democrats, the Republicans, the media are afraid to talk about oil, but that oil, in my mind, still remains the linchpin for the administration and for all those in the oil sector in the United States, Baker and Eagleburger counted among them, for why U.S. troops are being committed and committed to stay. And the report says troops will stay until at least 2008. I think that is at a minimum to guarantee this oil access to U.S. Oil companies. The Iraq Study Group report, page 1, chapter 1, says that the reason why Iraq is a critical country in the Middle East, in the world, and for the United States is because it has the second largest reserves of oil in the world. The report is very clear. The report is also very clear, however, that this isn't a report where the recommendations can be picked and choosed. It says that all of the recommendations should be applied together as one proposal, that they shouldn't be separated out. That means that the authors of the report are saying that oil, privatization of oil, and foreign corporate access to oil is as key as any other recommendation that they've made. And the report also says that the U.S. government will withhold military, economic, and political support of the Iraqi government unless the recommendations are met. That's a pretty straightforward statement. The U.S. government will not provide any support to the al-Maliki government unless it advances the changes to the Iraqi constitution and changes to Iraqi national law that essentially privatize Iraq's oil. That is something for us in the anti-war movement to be very, very clear about, that this is their objective, and that we have to, as I repeatedly say, not just call for the end of troops in Iraq, but make clear that the U.S. corporate invasion cannot be progressed or continue as well.
Canada's top police officer resigned amidst major political pressure Wednesday over the case of Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen deported by U.S. authorities to Syria. Stefan Christophe reports from Montreal.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police top officer Giuliano Zaccardelli resigned from office amid public outcry concerning his testimony before a committee of the Canadian House of Commons on major discrepancies within his public account of the RCMP's role in the case of Maher Arar. A Canadian citizen was deported from New York City to Syria by U.S. authorities in 2003, acting on information gathered from Canadian security services who had falsely identified Arar as connected to Al-Qaeda. John Tackerberry of Amnesty International in Ottawa.
There are roles played by officials in the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, within the Department of Foreign Affairs of the Canadian government. Those people who are responsible for elements of this failure on the part of the Canadian government have to be held accountable as well.
This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
The Israeli army opened fire at Palestinians near the border of the Gaza Strip today. The first violence breaking a week-old ceasefire between Palestinians and Israel. From Gaza, Rami Al-Maghari reports.
Sources said Thursday that two Palestinian farmers were shot and wounded after Israeli army opened fire on the northern Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses said that the two wounded were hit by Israeli fire while bending down in labor in their farmlands. Palestinian resistance factions considered the attack an Israeli violation that would undermine the ceasefire declaration. Fawzi Barhoum, spokesman of Hamas.
We have repeatedly said that if the Zionist occupation commits further crimes against the Palestinian people, the truce would be unstable.
Israeli sources claim that the Israeli soldiers manning the Israel-Gaza northern border spotted two men approaching the separation line and then opened fire on them. The Israeli government claims Palestinians have continued to fire small rockets into Israel despite the ceasefire. For Free Speech Radio News and IAMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari reporting from Gaza.
Optimism is starting to fade among the people of Afghanistan 5 years after the fall of the Taliban and amid rising violence in the country. And the number of people who think the country is on the right track has dropped 22 points to 55% in the last year. This is according to a poll done in Afghanistan by an ABC News and BBC World Service. The reasons cited most often for the pessimism were a bad economy and the resurgent power of the Taliban militia, whose severe Islamic rule was ended by the U.S.-led invasion. Most in Afghanistan still think the U.S.-led invasion 5 years ago had positive effects on their country. Almost 9 in 10 call the invasion a good thing for their country. 3/4 have favorable opinion of the United States, and almost 9 in 10 prefer the current government to the Taliban.
Indian authorities say 41,000 people have been killed during the 17-year insurgency in India administrative Kashmir. The Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Societies, a human rights group, says the figures are higher. They say an estimated 50,000 people have been killed and more than 10,000 are missing since the armed rebellion began against Indian rule. Officials say violence has decreased since India and Pakistan launched a peace process in 2004. An average of between 4 and 6 people a day are still killed in clashes.
Sri Lankan officials say 7 people were killed and 6 abducted today in the northeastern region of the island nation. The violence comes as the government again invoked strict provisions of an anti-terror law. Ponia Mahnika Basagam reports.
Military officials accused the Tamil Tiger rebels for the killings of 3 civilians and wounding 12 students in an artillery fire today, a day after the government imposed the Anti-Terror Act. The government's decision to reinvoke the Prevention of Terrorism Act followed a suspected rebel suicide bombing attempt to kill the defense secretary last week. The new regulations prohibit all terrorist symbols and any contact with terrorist groups. Violators can be imprisoned for up to 20 years. Human rights activists say the sweeping powers given to the forces will damage the rights of the ordinary civilians. The rebels say the government's move is a serious breach of the 2002 peace accords. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Bounia, Sri Lanka.
Ad agency Oxfam says more than 25,000 landless families in Indonesia's Aceh province are still without new homes following the tsunami 2 years ago. Oxfam reports that large numbers of people remain in cramped, often unhygienic, conditions in temporary barracks. And it says that those who were landless before the tsunami struck are being overlooked by rebuilding efforts. More than 130,000 people were killed and 500,000 left homeless in Aceh by the tsunami.
The United States has charged the son of former Liberian President Charles Taylor with committing torture. Charles MacArthur Emanuel, also known as Charles Chucky Taylor, is accused of taking part in the torture of a victim in Liberia in 2002 while his father was in power. American prosecutors are able to charge Emanuel because he was born in the U.S. It is the first time it has used the 1994 federal anti-torture law.
South Africa recently became the first African country to legalize same-sex marriage. From Uganda, Emmanuel Okello reports that some opponents to the law are suggesting an economic and cultural embargo on South Africa.
The South African Parliament on November 14th voted to pass the Civil Union Bill, which allows gay and lesbian couples to marry. The legislation has sparked uproar in Uganda. The homosexuals have welcomed it as a great step towards their freedom. Homosexuality is illegal in Uganda. If arrested, one could serve more than 6 years in jail. A local Ugandan who has been living undercover since 1989 when he discovered he was gay told FSRN that he was happy that Africa has started tolerating same-sex relationships.
Being a gay in Uganda, it is not something that is so easy, because you have to keep on in hiding. One, your family, many times you don't want them to know. The society where you are staying, you don't want them to know. Where you work, you don't want them to know, because when they get to know, you are intimidated. Yes, September I was hit. You see this? I was hit. And someone, when he went to police, he said, no, this guy wanted to fall in love with me. So you can see the problem we are in. So what we are asking the government to do and the society is just to tolerate. They might not accept us, that's fine. Just tolerate.
In South Africa, two men last Friday wedded, being the first couple to take advantage of the law passed only 2 weeks earlier. South Africa has one of the most liberal constitutions in the world. It specifically bans discrimination on the grounds of race, gender, and sexual orientation. Gay rights activists use the constitutional provision as a powerful legal tool, though South Africa remains largely conservative. Same-sex marriage has been legalized in Netherlands, Belgium, Canada, and Spain. Here in Uganda, a team of traditionalists, religious and civil society organizations have petitioned the South African President Thabo Mbeki, threatening an economic and cultural embargo against his country. One of the petitioners, Martin Semper, a leading AIDS activist in Uganda, says he's worried because South Africa operates several business empires across the continent. He fears that gay rights activists might infiltrate these companies to expand their influence.
We gave 60 days to the government of South Africa. We wrote to Thabo Mbeki and said, Mr. Mbeki, you better give people a referendum, break this law down, otherwise we are going to put an economic embargo in the same way as apartheid was wrong against African people. That means we will not use their phone services, we will not use their trade services, we will have a cultural embargo on South Africa. That way we can send a strong message to South African government that Africa will not embrace homosexuality. This is a continent that needs repentance. Countries that embrace homosexuality are inviting disease and death. No wonder this can explain why South Africa has the highest HIV in the world. Whoa, way! We are crying because of South Africa today.
The church in Uganda rejects homosexuality as a sinful action and has denied homosexuals the right of a Christian burial. In 2003, the Anglican Church in America ordained Gene Robinson, making him the church's first ever gay bishop. His appointment caused controversy among about 18 million Anglican communities around the world. The rift ended with the Church of Uganda severing ties with the Episcopal Church in America. But controversial retired bishop from one of the dioceses in Uganda, Dr. Christopher Senyonjo, says the God's chief law is love, and that the church negates that principle when it refuses to accommodate the homosexuals.
My guiding principle, when you talk about the law of God, the chief law of God is to love. Love another person as you love yourself. So if you hate another person, you touch another person for being what he is, not because he is interfering with you. I don't see you, that would be the law of God.
The situation for Uganda's gay and lesbians has deteriorated in the last decade. In 1999, President Museveni instructed police to lock up and charge homosexuals. Uganda State Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Dr. James Nsavabuturo, said though South Africa has legalized homosexuality, is confident that such legislation would never find its way in Uganda. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okella reporting in Kampala, Uganda.
Malaria is fueling the spread of AIDS virus in Africa by boosting the HIV in people's bodies, says a new study by the University of Washington. Scientists have long suspected the diseases fuel each other. The new study created a mathematical model to figure out just how much. Malaria sickens up to 500 million people annually and kills more than 1 million, mostly young children and mostly in Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is home to 24.7 million HIV infected people. 2 million died this year. HIV is mostly spread when patients have high virus levels in their blood, and a bout of malaria case causes a temporary surge in those levels. The surge may last up to 6 or 8 weeks, far longer than it takes to recover from a typical malaria bout.
A study reports recent outbreaks of Ebola among people in Africa also killed thousands of gorillas, animals already threatened by hunting. Outbreaks in the Congo and Gabon killed as many as 5,500 gorillas and an uncounted number of chimpanzees. While conservationists had raised concerns about gorilla mortality previously, the study estimates how many died in the epidemic. With gorillas also being killed by commercial hunters, rapid ecological extinction might not be far off. They also found evidence of a large number of chimpanzee deaths, but said they did not have enough evidence to make an estimate of the total. The research was funded by Energy Africa Oil Company, the European Union, and the University of Barcelona.
A Zimbabwe government report says living standards in the country have declined by 150% since 1995. The survey by the Social Welfare Ministry says around 63% of rural people and 53% in urban areas cannot meet the basic cost of living. The report says poverty has been deepened by droughts, floods, HIV/AIDS, and the withdrawal of international donor support. Many critics have accused Robert Mugabe's government of mismanaging the economy.
Somalia's Union of Islamic Courts has warned they will fight any peacekeepers sent by the UN. The UN Security Council earlier voted to send an 8,000-member peacekeeping force to protect Somalia's weak transitional government from the Islamists. The U.S.-led resolution also urged the government to resume peace talks and ease a 1992 arms embargo so Somalia's government forces could rearm. The Union of Islamic Courts have seized the capital, Mogadishu, and much of the south and central Somalia.
6 independent newspapers in Chad have started a 15-day strike protesting censorship introduced by the government last month. Several private radio stations will not broadcast news for the next 3 days. President Idriss Deby's government introduced censorship as part of emergency measures after rebel attacks in the east.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 7th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer and audio editor is Jessica Perry. Our wire editor is Jenna Thompson. Special thanks to reporter Amy Merwin. Our engineer is Matt Bingelli. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Sun Lee.
And I'm Arlise. Coming up tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, early, hear the KBOO Morning News. And then at 7:30 a.m., hear Ani and Melody. They'll be hosting Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Their guest is Lauren C. Regan, the Executive Director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. The topic is the Green Scare, targeting of environmental and human rights activists and maintaining solidarity. At 9 on Marlena's Electronic Salon, the guest is local naturopath Dr. Stephen Daly. Stephen Bailey at 10. Marlena speaks with Dr. Michael Greger, author of Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching. Dr. Greger is Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. At 11, Amy Goodman hosts Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO. We are your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community station. Volunteer with our humble newscast. Call 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thank you for joining us. The publisher of the Portland Alliance invites you to celebrate 25 years of non-corporate community publishing. On Saturday, December 9th, you are invited to a fundraiser, dinner, auction, and celebration of the Portland Alliance. Events will include a silent auction featuring local quilts, art, and other artifacts of interest. Dinner and music by General Strike and a special musical roast of the Mainstream Press by Melinda Pittman, founder of the Fallen Angel Choir. Enjoy an evening of food, friends, and music while supporting your independent media news, the Portland Alliance. This event will be held at St. Andrew Catholic Church Community Center, 806 Northeast Alberta Avenue in Portland. Advance tickets may be purchased by calling 503-239-4991 or by logging on to www.theportlandalliance.org. That's Saturday, December 9th, beginning at 6 p.m. KBOO is proud to co-sponsor this event.
It is 6:01. Coming up next is Africa on Fire. And tonight it's going to be about African storytelling, so stay tuned. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Chula.
Welcome to Africa on Fire on KBOO Radio. Africa
on Fire is a news and public affairs broadcast committed to Africa and her people. We're now streaming live to Africa and around the world via the internet at kboo.org. Tonight, local artist and illustrator Babawage Jakate remembers childhood stories from Mali. We'll talk to the World Affairs Council about their new Teach Africa program. Plus more international and local African news the corporate media won't divulge. I'm your host, Marianne Fry. Join us. Africa is on fire.
Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.
Local news and events later in the hour, but first, Africa on Fire's international African news. Joining me is 14-year-old Oromian-American Aya Youssef. We're going to go live to Africa, Mali, West Africa, to hear a live from the continent report from Portland's Babawage Jakate. He arrived in Mali last week. Hello, Wage.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good, Wage. I know it's 2 a.m. in the morning there in Mali, so thanks for staying up late to talk to us. I'm here with Aya Youssef, and we're interested to know, what are people talking about there this week in the capital city of Bamako?
Well, people are talking right now about the difficulties of the moment, and also the weather. The weather is a big thing. It's currently 68 degrees in Bamako, and which is basically 20 degrees Celsius, and this is something people are not used to. So everybody, you know, Bamako is a city that never go to sleep. So therefore, these days, people fill up their little furuno with hot coals and enter in their room earlier. At this moment, I am here with a niece from Portland who is also very much enjoying this weather very much along with me.
This is Aya Youssef. What kinds of stories are the African media
But the poverty
reporting?
And the poverty of the moment is a very hot issue right now.
Hmm. Okay. And Wage, Aya Youssef has a question for you.
This is Aya Youssef. What kinds of stories are the African media reporting there in Mali?
I have a hard time hearing you right now.
This is Aya Youssef. What kinds of stories are the African media reporting there in Mali?
Wage,
I do have a hard time hearing you.
Okay, Wage, Aya Youssef is asking you, what kinds of stories are the African media reporting there in Mali?
Well, right now there's a lot of diplomacy issues going on, especially toward Europe. And when I was on the airplane from Air France, I personally witnessed some students being evacuated from France and with handcuffs in their hand. I think this is the kind of things that is a hot issue right now. Because Africans, I believe have discovered the importance of education and international relationship. So therefore, this issue of handcuffing African students from the city of Paris, because sometimes for reasons because they are sick. Not because of they are not learning, because they're sick and they feel it's a burden for them. So therefore, these are the kind of things that are being talked about recently, especially, you know, students' organizations are not accepting this kind of conduct from France. I heard a lot about this recently.
Okay, great. Wage, thank you so much for this live from the Continent Report. and we'll see you when you return in January. Please give Portland greetings to the people of Mali.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greeting to all.
Thank you. That was Baba Wage Jakate speaking to Africa on Fire in a Live from the Continent report from Mali, West Africa. We continue with international African news.
The French ambassador to Rwanda has been expelled. The Rwandan government gave Dominique de Cherf 24 hours to leave the country last week. The French embassy in Rwanda was then immediately closed. This comes in the wake of arrest warrants issued by French magistrate Jean-Louis Bergouir, in which he claims that officers of the Rwanda Patriotic Front Army were involved in the shooting down of a plane carrying Rwanda's former president. On November 24th, the Rwandan Information Minister, Professor Laurent Nusky, announced that all French-aided projects in the country were to close within 72 hours. Nkusi said, we see no reason to keep the French mission in Kigali active at this point. France is intent at destroying our government. We do not see any need for keeping any relationship with a hostile country. The New Times in Kigali also reports that Rwandans demonstrated against France at the French embassy in Washington, D.C., and in several countries throughout Europe last Friday.
South Africa has become the first African country to legalize same-sex marriage. South Africa is only the fifth country in the world to recognize such unions. While some said the law addressed inequalities left over from the apartheid era, others, including traditional African leaders, were angered, saying the measure violates African customs and morals. This according to the Voice of America.
The president of the Islamic Network for Development has advised Muslim youth to obtain HIV testing and said that ignorance is forbidden in Islam. This day, newspaper reports that Haya Oshodi advised youth to find out their AIDS status as they prepared for marital life. She recently addressed Islam youth in Lagos, Nigeria. Oshodi said, as a religious group, we have displayed too many indifference and silence. Our overt attitude cannot be justified by the rich resources and information that Islamic has on reproductive health issues.
The African Development Bank has granted six countries a $76 million loan to combat sleeping sickness. The countries named are Benin, Niger, Chad, Central African Republic, and Cameroon. The tsetse fly, which causes the disease, claims 50,000 lives and 3 million cattle every year. Annually, 500,000 people are infected with the sleeping sickness. The disease undermines African economies with an estimated loss of $4.5 billion annually. 37 countries identify sleeping sickness as one of Africa's biggest problems. There's no vaccine against the disease, and no new drugs are being developed. Experts say current drugs are highly toxic, difficult to administer, are largely ineffective due to widespread drug resistance. This according to the Daily Champion newspaper in Lagos. The first summit of leaders from Africa and South America was held in Nigeria last week. Leaders in the capital city of Abuja declared a declaration and a plan of action aimed at strengthening cooperation between the two regions. Areas addressed include the United Nations reform, World Trade Organization negotiations, and legal justice. According to the Mozambique News Agency, a second South America-Africa summit will be held in Venezuela in 2009. The last China-Africa summit was held in Beijing in November. The early EU-Africa summit is expected to take place in Lisbon in 2007, according to the Southern Africa News feature. And yesterday in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Joseph Kabila was sworn in as the country's first democratically elected president in more than 40 years. At 35 years of age, Kabila has become the youngest African head of state. He faces rebuilding this vast country after years of war and dictatorship in which more than 4 million people have died. You've been listening to International African News on Africa on Fire. I'm Marianne Fry with Aya Youssef. When we come back, we'll hear from local Malian artist and illustrator Baba Wage Jakate. Earlier in the program, we heard from Baba Wage Jakate live in Mali. Born in Mali, West Africa, Portland's Baba Wage Jakate is internationally known for his ceramic pottery. He has created large-scale installations for the Oregon Zoo, Oregon State University, Disney World, and the Taguna Cultural Center in Mali. Wage is the author and illustrator of several children's books. His book, The Magic Gourd, A West African Folktale, is a Library of Congress Africana Book Award winner. The Hunter Man and the Crocodile was named a Coretta Scott King honor book. But he knows the value and wisdom of oral storytelling. I asked Baba Wage Jakate what kinds of stories he heard growing up in Mali.
I grew up in a very small town, and I had so many cousins that were all sent to my grandparent for their first education. And this education was strictly storytelling. And a lot of time when you talk about education, people think that it just has to see with, you know, writing, reading Western style. But, you know, when I was growing up, it was right at the end of colonization. And my grandmother really didn't, you know, like, she didn't support the idea of sending children to Western schools. You know, from her experience, what she sees, she thinks that it's just to trashed up children again. So she recommended that they all come back to the village and learn the way of nature there and through their elders. So she was the main storyteller. However, everybody in the compound tells stories, and these stories are animal stories. Therefore, even though they're animal stories, they are truly based on human beings. They're all about human beings. So, you know, if a child is growing up in Africa, you can tell that their everyday exposure to life is really through story. Because even a mother sometimes will not forbid a child from doing something, but will recite a proverb. It's the child that will interpret the message back to a mother. And here, usually, we put the children in timeout, you know. So it's a little different. All this way of talking to children help their thinking process. And this is why when we say African folk tales are, you know, animals' tale, but they're really based on human being. It's children who grew up listening to it really know how to translate it well and put it in the right concept in their life.
One of the themes that I hear you talking about is that human beings are not above animals mm-hmm. or any other form of life. Can you mm-hmm. talk more about that?
Anybody that grew up in Africa will have a sense of that, because before I even started Western school, French school in Africa, as I said, I spent 14 years in the village. And, you know, through animals, traditional folk tales, stories, I learned so much from animals. I know that, you know, they have been the guide to men in many areas in life. And, you know, as we have been also to them. So, you know, the other creature, I call them the other creature. Our relationship with them, it's not really to eat them. It is to learn from them. And so men and animals have been learning from each other from the beginning of things. And they are, in many ways, our ancestors. They have a lot more experience in this life than we do. And I think they deserve that respect. And we human beings, we are not always self-conscious. Once we get what we want, we forget where we get it. And that's the biggest problem in the world. I think if people realize that the way their life is, the way, you know, you know, they're living in luxurious lifestyle come from somewhere else. They will try to find out where it come from. And if you really try to find that out, you will only find the connection from culture to culture and all the way to the animal world. I don't think there's anything that we're doing in this life called the so-called civilization that we didn't actually get it from animals. But we are always in denial.
What role do oral historians play in Africa today?
Oral history and traditional folk tales are completely two different things, because oral historians are from specific line of the family line, specific family line. And in this family, everybody can be a storyteller. But the kind of stories they tell is completely different than folk tale, because in traditional folk tale, everybody can tell story because it is sort of a way of teaching people about the nature. However, the oral historians are the ones that keep the history of one kingdom, one country, or a family line. And those family lines that are oral historians are all over in Africa, not just West Africa, I will say. It's all across the continent. You know, the job of an oral historian is basically talk about the past to help people to figure it out the future. And they will talk about, you know, great heroes that once lived on the land and what they, you know, what they did, and they will constantly speak about the positiveness of their lives. And sometimes, you know, depending on where you really grow up, you know, we don't really take stories, you know, the way the Western people, you know, take stories, because sometimes I have a lot of little folk tales, but I can't tell them because it's considered, if it just doesn't, you know, bring this kind of this positiveness to it, sometimes it can be a problem. For example, in the West, everything is way too serious. Absolutely. Because, you know, when I was in Mali, when I moved from the village to the big city, I was sort of like a teacher for a while. And the way we will do that is do puppet shows. Because there was lots of children that didn't want to go to school. And their grandparents supported, just the same way my grandmother was not in support of us going to school. And sometimes these kids will just be in the neighborhood, you know, hanging out. They don't want to go to the garden. They don't want to go to the farm. And so what I find out when I first came in the big city, my mother had told me to actually teach my youngsters the village life. And then the easiest way for me to do that for them was to create this puppet show. And the puppet show will be telling these traditional folk tales. But beforehand, I will introduce them to French alphabets and so on. You know, so those, you know, folk tales that that I used to animate with the children and teach them become somewhat the key to open the door to education for them. And nowadays I travel back to Mali with my wife, and you know, big guys come to my wife and said, your husband was my first teacher. So I know these stories really work in many, many ways, and this is why it's encouraged in the, you know, tradition in Mali.
What kind of values in education did you present to the children with your puppet show?
Well, I actually let them know, first of all, at a very early age, that they are part of life, because that's the first thing that story tell you. You know, if you feel like you're above everything, if you sit down and listen to, because the stories, these traditional folk tales, are not just all made up words. They are they actually are structured from our own day-to-day life. And all the kids that know stories very well understand that, help their behavior. Good behavior, good story. Bad behavior, bad stories. But, you know, every time you tell story that, you know, doesn't, you know, end happily ever after, it has its own lesson. For someone who is greedy, I would say, will always constantly expect this beautiful, happily ever ending stories. But stories are not about that. They're not funny entertainment. They are based on the reality of life. So twisting stories certain ways actually take the flavor, the educational flavor away from it. You know, I remember one time my grandmother would tell us a story about death, which is, you know, in the Western culture, this is very, very dark subject, you know. And, you know, now that I've been here for 20 years, I can understand, because I think people don't know the difference between being killed and dying. It's completely different thing. So she would tell us a story about, you know, a beautiful, tall, strong man. You know, his name was Death. He will often come to a village, and when he comes, he was the most charming man. He will visit everybody and was funny, but his very most stressful friend was the blacksmith. So when he finishes greeting and so on, he will go to his friend and, you know, spend the rest of the day there chatting if there's no work, and he will sleep a little bit. He was so polite too, because if he comes to take your soul away, he will warn you and said, "Boy, I'm sent to you today, and so what can we do about it?" And he was patient. People will tell him, "Okay, wait, after a while you can come back," and he will do that. Well, it just came one time that his best friend, the blacksmith, he was sent to him and take his soul. Well, when the blacksmith heard that, he says, "Well, I have a lot of tools to mend. You know, this whole village is farming village, so I have to mend all these tools before the beginning of August. So will you spare me for a week?" And he said, "No problem, I'll spare you. And so next week I will come back." So the next week when he came back, indeed, the blacksmith was not quite ready again. So he said, "Well, I still have about 5 knives to sharpen, so why don't you just lie down and feel at home?" So the deaf lied down in the little blacksmith shop, and by the time you know it, he was going... He was sleeping deep, and he enjoyed sleeping in the warmth of the blacksmith hat that he tried to stretch, and by doing that, his foot or his toe was placed right on top of a hot metal that just came out of the coal, and soon he jumped up, he woke up. When he woke up, instead of asking, it was so painful, Death got up and start running away. And man, and everybody was surprised to see Death going, you know, creating dust behind him. And then it was told that Death went back to the Creator. And he says, "Creator, the people of Earth are very dangerous. So if you don't help me, I will be dead someday." Death himself was afraid of death. So therefore, the Creator said, "No problem." He gave him a vest, and he says, "If you wear this vest, nobody will lay eye on you again." So I guess from that time to now, the deaf always wear his vest before he starts his expeditions. That's the end. So stories like that, I wouldn't even really see stories like that in front of children, because of the society had made it a very frightening thing, that if you tell negative things, and children will go negative.
Here in America, you're talking about, you're afraid to tell.
Yeah, here in America. So you really, can get a bunch of knowledge is over there, but when you come here, it's very difficult to express yourself because of the structure of the society.
We're talking to Babawage Jakate, artist, illustrator, children's book author, and storyteller, one of Portland's own. It's difficult not to smile when you're in the room. I wanted to ask you, I know that you just finished building a cultural center in Mali. What role will storytelling play at your cultural center?
Well, I would say in a way the idea of Tuguna Cultural Center really come from, gathering together. You know, everybody who knows me will tell you that there's always people walking in and out of my home, and I come from a culture where social life is very, very important, because it is through that the social life that we actually live life the best. And so the idea of Tuguna came when I started 18 years ago, inviting whoever want to come amongst my friends to visit my native country in Mali. And of course I had lots of volunteers, and for 18 years I've been going with people, sometimes 5 people a year, sometimes 10 people other years. And when we come there, at first I was concerned how I will be able to take care of this many people in Africa. But, as an African, I was surprised I had that concern, because, we always let things go. We let things solve themselves. And so when I began traveling with people to Mali, we had a really happy, American African family. My family is so wonderful. They're all so welcoming, and so everybody that comes are automatically part of the family, And my mother will be giving them African name to all of them. She probably named over 20 people. So, but at the same time, neighbors will come and do their formal greeting, and they will hang out. And so through this, I think this is how my friends started, developing their own little friendship in the neighborhood. In many cases, in the late evenings, I will try to figure it out where some of them are. And, I will be walking around the neighborhood and find someone sitting, with, some family here and there. That really triggered my mind, because this is something that I wanted to do in my heart, to bring people, not to treat them like tourists, to treat them just the way we will treat each other in Africa. And, I am the creator of it, but the situation worked itself out, because, they make their own friend. Every time I find someone somewhere like that, I am so happy. And either with a mud cloth maker, a potter, or a bunch of children sitting drawing. And I said, this is a great idea. I think I need to, continue doing this. And it's the best way to expose the Mali culture to, my friends and those Americans that want to come to Mali. And so the idea of Tuguna came through that. But when I started building Tuguna, yet people still come with us. We had oral historians that will come and play music for us and to relax us more. And neighborhood women will come and sing songs through stories, because I forgot to tell you, stories are not just, folk tales are not just said, as I said, they're sung, and they're, they clap and dance it, and so much more. So I think, I said, well, this is great. I like to create a place that will be called Tuguna, meaning the place where you solve problems. So therefore, that's where the idea of Tuguna came about. But, you know, through it, you know, even Tuguna is not even finished yet. But already other things are kind of creating themselves within, like my daughter creating this relationship between her school and a village school in Bamako, in Mali.
And that's Jackson Middle School in Southwest
Portland.
Yes,
Jackson Middle School. Stories can be sung and danced, so I'm going to tell you, I'm going to sing you a story. Kono ni mbe demi se umbolo, kono ni nko wai. Kono ni nko lai, lai la la ma, madarasulu lai, ala man la banyena. Kono ni fate fewa wolo, fa bere dunte kono ni fe. Kono ba da ka umbolo, kono ni bate fewa wolo, ba bere dunte kono ni fe. Kono ba da kambolo, kono ni kushi ubana, kono ni nyambo bela, kono ni kashi ubana, kono ni nyambo bela, kono ni nyashi ubana, kono ni nyambo bela, kono ni ndashi ubana, kono ni nyambo bela, tulunu mbe dagani kono, kono ni nyambo bela, kokonu mbe galama kono, kono ni nyambo bela, jabanu mbe koloni kono, Kono ni nyembo bela, kono ni nko lai, lai la la ma, madarasulu lai, ala ma la banyena. The end. So it's about a mother and children. And in Africa, when the mother goes to the marketplace and, you know, children take care of each other. And the oldest one is the, everybody's supposed to listen to him. And so on. The older you are, the better chance you have over other children. But they do take care of each other very well, you know. It happened one day after a big rainy storm that the mother left as usual to the marketplace. But the children have discovered a little bird that was cold from the rain, the coldness of the rain. And also the bird was crawling at the foot of the tree. And when children discovered the little bird, they grabbed the little bird. And they brought a cloth to dry him up and took him to the kitchen. Now, when the birds got into the kitchen, the birds saw every spices that were necessary for cooking a meat. So therefore, this kind of scared the little bird up, and it began to shiver. And the children keep saying, "Oh, little bird, what's going on?" And so, but in the mind of the little bird is saying, "I can see a little black peppers in the pot. I can see a little salt and onions." But the kids cannot hear that, so they really think that the little bird is gonna die right away. So the mother also, who came from the market and just walked into the situation, you know, could not understand why the kids are bringing the little bird into the kitchen. So she had the same thought as the little bird itself. So she said, "You better let this little bird go." And, you know, as a mother will do in Africa, she tell them a proverb, you know, to help them understand. And, you know, the proverb, the proverb escaped me, but she told them a proverb, which led to the freedom of the little bird. So, you know, it's just kind of for small kids. Mm-hmm. They love to hear the singing of it rather than the telling of the story.
Portland's Baba Wage Jakate about the role of oral historians.
Oral historians, they are the blood flow of African countries. You know, many of African countries don't have their own writing. It is through this oral historian that we get to learn about our ancestors, the great kings, the great heroes of the past. But in the past, oral historians belong to the royal family. You know, even though, you know, they were the most precious people, because nobody could dispute, could argue with the king except the oral historian. The king, kings of Africa listened to the advice of the oral historian. That's how powerful they were. Because if you cut the head of an oral historian, you cut off the head of your own library. You know, I mean, there's nothing to say. So the great thing about it growing up in these, you know, early 60s to 70s, even now, the oral historian actually play a very important role in the country of Mali, because they are on the radio all the time. Everybody learn about the history of their ancestral line, and everybody learn about the structure of the country every day through the bards, the oral historian. So nowadays, because this precious position is no longer in existence, since there is no king, there is nobody close to that that will help them, that is what created a variety of musicians, you know, from these people. And yet, you know, when weddings are taking place or baby naming ceremonies, oral historians will come and they will praise the history of the family, of the baby. So if this happened in front of you with all consciousness, somebody talking about the heroic deed of your ancestor, you will get up and give something, you know, because that's, you believe this is what your forefathers will have done.
You give something monetary.
Yes, mm-hmm. Nowadays. Mm-hmm. So, but in the old time, the kings house them and they play music and sing and praise the royal family only.
Last month at his Southeast Portland home, Baba Wage Jakate updated me on his Tuguna Cultural Center in Bamako. As we heard at the beginning of the hour, Wage is now in Mali. He's overseeing the completion of his center. He's excited about its grand opening in November of 2007 and promises that, yes, there'll be lots and lots of storytelling. Wage will tell captivating stories at Family Film Day, part of the annual Cascade Festival of African Films. The date is Saturday, February 17th, 2 p.m. at McMinimum's Kennedy School in Northeast Portland. More information will be available after the first of the year at the website africanfilmfestival.org. We're back here in the studio with Aya Yusuf. Aya, you did a terrific job of informing our listeners about the Muslim holiday of Eid a couple of years ago. I think you were 11 years old then, and you just recently turned 14. Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
And you're the daughter of Muhammad and Khadija Yusuf. I know you and your family identify with being a Romo as opposed to being called Ethiopian. Some of our listeners might be curious to know why this is.
We call ourselves a Romo because that's what we are. That's the language we speak. That's the part of Ethiopia we come from. There are many states in Ethiopia as there are in the United States. Oromia is one of them. We have a totally different language, style of dress, type of music, and culture than the Amharic and Tigray and rest of Ethiopia. not many people have heard of the Oromian region because it's not a very known part of Ethiopia unless you've been to the Oromo section. It is the largest city in Ethiopia with the largest population. Did you know that Ethiopian Hara coffee came from the Oromo section?
No, I didn't know that.
That is where my family is from, Hara State. We call ourselves Oromo because we're proud of who we are.
Great. I understand your mother told you Ethiopian fables. Can you share one of these with us?
Yes. My mother told me this and her mother told her this. The tales of Nuas. Once upon a time, there was a guy named Amnuas. He went to the king's palace. He noticed that the king's palace was nicer than his. He asked himself, why does the king live in a beautiful palace and I live in an ugly mini house? So he went home and burned his house down to ashes. He took his ashes and traveled to different cities. The second city, the people invited him to come stay with them. He answered, no, I have some very valuable things on my donkey. They replied, we will keep it safe for you. Don't worry. The next morning, Abnuas cried and yelled that his gold had burned to ashes. The people said, oh no, we'll pay your gold back. So he went back home with the gold. From that tale comes a saying, anyone who goes to the king's house, they burn their own house.
What have you learned from this tale?
This tale tells me the funny things a guy who is blinded with jealousy can do.
Thank you, Aya Yusuf.
Be still, my child. Be still, my child. Do not cry, mother is absent, mother shall come back. Do not cry, mother is absent, mother shall come back. Be still.
Time now for Africa on Fire's local and regional news. The World Affairs Council presents a Teach Africa conference for kindergarten through 12th grade educators this Saturday. New material and methodologies about Africa will be introduced. With us on the phone is Karen Ettinger, director of the K-12 education program at the World Affairs Council. Hello, Karen.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I was rather shocked when a teacher from a highly regarded high school here told me they don't teach students about Africa, so it's good to hear about your resource. Can you tell our listeners about the Teach Africa program and how it came about?
Okay, I'd be happy to. We were approached by an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Africa Society of the National Summit on Africa, and they had been doing a pilot program in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco called Teach Africa. The focus of Teach Africa is to elevate the level of knowledge of teachers about Africa so that they can bring that knowledge to the classroom. And it's a three-phase program. We began in October with an outreach to principals and administrators, and then we notified them about the conference and asked them to tell their teachers about it. And as a result, our conference is full with 250 teachers. We're really excited about that, with a day-long program that hopefully will really just begin to scratch the surface of what they need to know about Africa.
That's great. What does the Teach African curriculum include, and what will educators be prepared to take to their classroom after Saturday's forum?
Okay. Well, every high school teacher and middle school teacher will go home with a program called Africa in Transition, which is a really top-rated program that was created by another World Affairs Council in Atlanta, Georgia, called the Southern Center, and has been highly recommended by Kofi Annan. And the elementary teachers will go home with a beautiful program called Africa is Not a Country. Both during the morning, during the curriculum sessions, they'll be trained in how to use these programs. And then we're going to have a beautiful African-style lunch, East African-style lunch. And during the lunch hour, there'll be opportunities for teachers to visit action tables. We're calling it our Africa Action Fair. It's part of the World Affairs Council's From Awareness to Action program. And there'll be 15 nonprofits there. The teachers will be able to visit them and learn about them and try to find ways to incorporate what they gain from these organizations and service learning projects. And then in the afternoon, there's going to be 13 breakout sessions addressing all kinds of topics that we decided on these topics while working with Portland State University's African Studies Program and the Office of International Affairs. We interviewed students from Africa that are going to PSU, and we talked with Dr. Kofi Agorsa, who's head of that program, and came up with some great topics that they thought were things that they wanted teachers to know about Africa. Everything from language to women in the family, to politics and governance. And there'll be teachers involved in teaching the breakout sessions in the afternoon. There's a group of teachers who went with the Oregon Geographic Alliance this summer to Botswana on a Fulbright-Hays scholarship, and they're going to teach two sessions that will incorporate the lesson plans that they created as a result of their experience. So we are going to have an ambassador here too from Lesotho, and I hope I pronounce her name correctly. It's Mola King, Her Excellency Mola King E. Rapalaki, and so we're going to be honored with having her do the keynote address.
Karen, this is Aya Youssef. You are educating about 250 teachers this Saturday. What are your future goals for the Teach Africa program?
Well, since it's a three-phase program, our goal is to stay in touch with the teachers that are using these materials in their classrooms, and then organize, hopefully next year, this is depending on funding, of course, a youth forum for maybe up to 1,000 high school students. We also, as the World Affairs Council, are going to create, try to be a central clearinghouse for materials that that come to us through these teachers, things that they are already doing in their classrooms that they can share with others, and also to create an African Speakers Bureau and work with local people that live here from different African countries and entice them to come and tell their stories in the classrooms, because I think that's the way that kids are really going to learn, is to have a chance to meet people from different African countries to see what a diverse continent it is. It is definitely not a country.
How can people get a hold of you for more information about this Teach Africa program?
Okay. They could call me at the World Affairs Council. My number here is 503-274-7488, or they could email me at karen@worldoregon.org.
Thank you.
And I almost forgot to mention, we have a wonderful center up at Portland State where we have culture boxes from around the world that we loan to the schools, and we have many culture boxes on many different African countries that can bring a real hands-on experience to the classroom.
Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
That was Karen Ettinger of the World Affairs Council talking to Africa on Fire about their upcoming Teach Africa program. In other local African news, Beaverton resident and Egyptian-American Mona Mayfield and her husband Brandon Mayfield won a $2 million lawsuit against the federal government last Wednesday. In May of 2004, Mona and her husband, attorney Brandon Mayfield, were simultaneously accosted by the FBI. The FBI falsely arrested Muslim convert Brandon Mayfield for the deadly Madrid-Spain train bombing in May of 2004. For months, their home and office were searched and bugged with cameras and microphones. They believe being Muslim was a factor in their ordeal. They will now proceed with challenging the constitutionality of the Patriot Act.
The Egyptian government has loaned out the largest selection of antiquities to ever come to North America. The Portland Art Museum displays over 100 artifacts from the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, the Luxor Museum, and the sites of Tunis and Deir el-Bahr. Explore ancient Egyptian beliefs about the afterlife, including walking through a replica tomb. The exhibit runs through March 4th of next year. For more information on tickets and museum hours, visit portlandartmuseum.org or call 503-226-2811. help organize events about genocide. The Portland Coalition for Genocide Awareness seeks area to help organize local events about genocide. You can contact this new grassroots organization by calling Sarah at 503-282-1108.
The African Community Coalition of Oregon presents Movie Mondays. The next African films will be shown at 6 p.m. December 11th at the PCC Workforce Network located at 5600 Northeast 42nd Avenue, Building 2 in the auditorium. For more information, call 503-761-0243. Kagotso African Cultural Arts presents Half of Myself. This dialogue between Africans and African Americans through dance and music is created and presented by Portland Zimbabwean Love Nweso. Performances are Tuesdays, December 12th, 19th, and 26th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center at 5340 North Interstate in Portland. Presentations will also be held at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus, December 14th through 17th. For tickets and additional information, call 503-281-4599.
12 Ugandan teenage girls were each given a camera and 24 hours to tell their stories about being AIDS orphans. View this photo voice exhibit titled Zoom Uganda, December 20th through January 12th. It's at the Eco Trust Building, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland, and it's open from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. More information from the Harambee Center at 503-544-5790.
For more information about African dance and drumming classes taught by Ghanaian master drummer Ni Ardley Alate, call 503-236-8283. Teach English to Somali Bantu women Tuesdays or Thursday evenings. This group is affiliated with Catholic Charities and the Immigrant and Refugee Community of Oregon. The teaching location is around Southeast Powell and 27th Street. For more information, contact KDJ at 503-349-4946. Seattle's African events are at ibike.org/AfricaMatters. Send your African-related events, news, or comments about the program to us at africaonfire@yahoo.com. Thanks to our guests, Baba Wage Jakate and Karen Ettinger. Aya Youssef is our guest co-host. Tonight's lead producer is Aaron Yankee. Field recorders were Karifa Kroma and Rob Manning. Engineer is Kebu, board member Judy Feastel. Elder consultants are Grace Kuto and Bosco Conte. For Africa on Fire, I'm host and founder, Marianne Fry. Join us next first Thursday, January 4th, 2007. As we close this year, we leave you with the South African recording of A Prayer for Our Time. In this new year, how will you connect to the great continent of light? Africa is on fire.
Grinning's mouth and thirst of the earth.